to conclude these introductory lectures by saying something about order of vanishing of eigenfunctions. So, assume that I have a C infinity Riemannian manifold. And I guess in the previous two lectures, I've been assuming M is compact. I don't need that at the beginning today. So I will, though, need connectedness. And suppose I start with an eigenfunction. Now, since this is a C-infinity manifold with a C-infinity metric, of course, F, anything that satisfies this eigenvalue equation by the standard elliptic theory will be a C-infinity function. And at the moment, all I'll need is that equation is satisfied. I don't need that it belongs to L2 or any such thing. So the manifold could be non-compact. And you could have any growth on this for what I'm going to say. All right, so let me start with the fundamental theorem about order of vanishing of eigenfunctions. So this is due to Aaron Sargent and Cortez. Now, this is two independent papers, and they both proved this close to the same time. And this theorem is that if your eigenfunction vanishes to infinite order at a point, so this means that its Taylor series is all the terms in the Taylor series are zero. Then F is identically zero. Now, the main interest of this is that, and a little bit of a surprise, perhaps, if you haven't seen it before, is that I'm only assuming that I have a C-infinity manifold. So if it were a real analytic manifold, then the elliptic theory would say that the eigenfunction had to be an analytic function. But nevertheless, this theorem says something that wouldn't come from that basic elliptic theory, that even on C-infinity manifolds, if the Taylor series is identically zero, the eigenfunction has to be identically zero. So let me say what the main tool is for proving this. Because later in the lecture, I wanted to get some more recent, deeper results, but nevertheless, they're built on this foundation. So the basic tool for proving theorems about order of vanishing of eigenfunctions is the following Coulomb inequality. Now, this particular Coulomb inequality that I'm about to state is more refined than what you really need to prove Theorem 1, but I want to do the lecture efficiently, so I'll just have one Coulomb inequality, and I'll use it for other purposes later in the lecture. So this particular version is due to Pfefferman and myself, but it's built out of the work mostly of Ehrenschein, actually. All right, so what's the statement? And so we start with something which is not necessarily an eigenfunction. It's just, I mean, it actually won't be an eigenfunction. So we have just some compactly supported function. And it has to have support, say, in some annulus. R is the geodesic distance from a fixed base point. Actually, there's a lot of notation in this, so after I get this statement up here, I'll spend some time just unwinding what all the notation means. And this has to be small enough so that you stay within suitable Luhmer coordinates. Okay, so now again, we have another parameter beta, which is greater than this. The part of this which was due to Pfefferman and myself is the careful attention in these constants appearing in this, the dependence on the eigenvalue. That was not really necessary. It was not necessary just to prove this. It'll be needed later. So with sufficiently large constants, A1 and A2. Okay, and then I guess I better go over to the next blackboard. So under these assumptions, which I'll explain more in a minute, have a following integral inequality, r bar to the 2 minus beta, Plaussian minus lambda u squared, r inverse dr. t. Greater than constant beta squared integral r bar 2 minus 2 beta squared r inverse dr dt. Now actually this is all I need for the Ehrenstein-Cortez, but then for other purposes later want to have something stronger which has this additional term, but you can ignore at the moment this second term that I'm writing. That's the statement of it. Now, probably still some clarifications are needed as to what all the notation means. So let me put up here what I think needs to be said, and then if there are more questions, I'll answer those. So one thing is, what are R and T? So R and T are the geodesic spherical coordinates. No, I have to say that's going to be part of the clarifications, what R bar is. So R and T are geodesic spherical coordinates centered at some point. It's all local. It's, I guess, going to be applied at the same point which appears in the theorem eventually, where the function vanishes at infinite order. That's going to be the center of the coordinates. R bar is the following. I can only indicate roughly what it is. This would be a lot nicer if you could write actually R instead of R bar, that you didn't have to have two things. And you can do that in positive curvature, but this is going to be true for any metric. And so it's kind of a technicality, but a necessary one as far as I know, that R bar is a geodesic distance for a different metric, a conformally changed metric. But it's a metric which only differs from the original one to high order as you go to zero. So the limit is r goes to zero of r bar over r is one. See, if beta were fixed in this, it wouldn't really matter, but another point about this is that beta is another parameter which is going to be let go to infinity, and this has powers of beta in it. That's why you have to make this distinction between R bar and R. Now, what else can we say? So the two parameters are beta and lambda, so and delta, I suppose. So C1 and C2 are independent. Of beta, lambda, delta, and h. All right, so I hope that's enough clarification of what the notation means in this. Is there any questions about that? It's a specific conformal metric, and it has to do with changing. If you start with positive curvature, you don't need to change the metric. But if you have some negative curvature, then you have to change to a new metric which has locally positive curvature. Yeah. What? Well, the function has to have support in a sufficiently small ball, and so it's all local.
And the whole angle.
Hmm? All over the sphere, all angles. Yeah. Well, that's because in the proof of the theorem, when I'm going to let beta go to infinity and see then that this has the power r bar to the beta, so it really does make a difference.
Yeah.
That's why.
Yeah.
Maybe. I think of it as curvature, but that's not so much different. Yeah. So U is just any smooth function with support in here? Any function. All right, so how then do you prove this is called strong unique continuation from the Kahneman inequality. The Kahneman inequality, I'm afraid I'd have to have a longer lecture series if I were to attempt to prove the Kahneman inequality. So that, although it's strictly local, it's quite a complicated calculation. Lots of clever integration by parts to get it. And the part that Pfefferman and I did, see the original thing, Aaronchuk court, is they're not really concerned with dependence on lambda. And so we had to refine what Aaronchuk had to get this dependence on lambda. For example, here in his paper of Aaronchuk, he would just write Laplacian U squared. That's enough for the theorem one, but not enough for what I'm going to say later. All right, so the proof of this, as you might imagine, and that's why I said M was connected, is the standard elementary connectedness argument up to a point. And the significant part of it is to show that, so we need to show that the set where F vanishes to infinite order is open, because that's obviously closed and the manifold's connected. All right, so that's where the Coulombian inequality is used. Now, as was pointed out, this is just an arbitrary function. So what you do is you substitute into the Coulombian inequality your eigenfunction times a cutoff function. So u is equal to 5f, where f is the eigenfunction, and phi is a cutoff function. And it's identically 1 in some smaller annulus. So delta less than r less than h over 2. Okay, so what happens then when you do that? Okay, so since f is an eigenfunction and phi is 1 in this annulus, then since on the left-hand side you have Laplacian plus lambda u squared, some part of that is going to drop out in this smaller annulus, and you'll get on the left-hand side the two pieces where you get some contribution because of the cutoff, right? I mean, you're not allowed to put the eigenfunction itself in there because this is only true for u of compact support. And actually what we're trying to prove is that the eigenfunction can't be of compact support. So if we believe in what we're trying to prove, we know we can't put f itself in there. We have to cut it off first. All right, so we've got then r bar to the 2 minus beta. Now, as I said, this Coulombian inequality is more than I need at the moment, and that second term with the C2 only comes into play for what I'm going to say later. So to prove the basic theorem, I only need the first term, the one with the C1. And so I can say that this is greater than C1 beta squared integral r bar 2 minus 2 beta f squared or inverse dr dt. All right, now delta here is arbitrary. Now, I assume that at the center of this, f vanishes to infinite order. I'm trying to show that that set is open. So if that's so, then... yeah, but I think, see, I stayed in the range where phi is identically 1. I threw away this stuff. I see what mistake I made. Okay, so I meant to write here that I cut down the domain. All right, so I cut down the domain so that I just save the part where phi is identically 1, and then I can write them. All right, so since at the center f vanishes to infinite order, what I can do is I can let delta equal 0. Delta approaches 0. I'd say in principle, since it's r bar to the minus beta, and beta may be very large, if I didn't know that, I really couldn't do it. But now I can let go delta go to 0, since I'm assuming that the eigenfunction f vanishes to infinite order. Okay, and then I get this Okay, so then this then basically is supposed to lead to a contradiction when beta goes to infinity. So let beta go infinity to obtain a contradiction. Unless, or maybe I should say, I don't know how this should be phrased. Maybe it should be phrased in a positive way. So let's call this F to show see, if it didn't vanish on a neighborhood of this point where it vanishes in infinite order, there would be a contradiction here. Basically, the problem is that you're comparing on the left-hand side something of order h to the 2 to the minus 2 beta, and on the right-hand side, you're comparing something h over 4 to the minus 2 beta modulo stuff, which isn't all that big. And since it's just arithmetic, if you let beta go to infinity, 4 to the 2 beta is going to eventually be a lot bigger than 2 to the 2 beta, unless F vanishes on this ring, h over 4 to h over 2, you'll have a contradiction. So it has to be then that the set is open, and you can apply this to any sufficiently small h. So that's roughly the outline of the, how the Kalman inequality is used to prove unique continuation. Now, what can you do to try to develop this work? You can ask, yes? Yeah, basically, so this H naught is some sufficiently small thing so that you're within a normal coordinate system. So it's an integral of a small ball centered at a point where F vanishes to infinite order. That's where the integration takes place. Sufficiently small, right. Okay, so the next question, which I wanted to talk about then is to develop this, is to try to estimate, or to estimate eventually, the order of vanishing in terms of the eigenvalue. Now let me give an example first, which at least superficially seems quite discouraging that you can do that. And this is from my first lecture, I suppose. So in the first lecture, we talked about the spherical harmonics. Now, just think of them on Rn at the moment. So on Rn, you have harmonic polynomials.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I haven't thought about that. That's interesting.
Actually, even if you go in continuous space, but the force of the equation is not necessarily true, because
yeah.
The force of the equation is not necessarily unit.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. Most of the things about elliptic equations generalize, but this particular thing, as you say, doesn't. You need continuation. You know, there are counterexamples, also for elliptic systems. Okay, so as far as making the thing quantitative, on our end, you have the harmonic polynomials. So Rn can be the M, because I'm not really assuming yet that it's compact. And they obviously vanish to arbitrarily high order. But the eigenvalue is zero. See, so if your goal is to make this quantitative, which means that you would estimate to what order the thing could vanish in terms of the eigenvalue, this at least superficially looks somewhat discouraging, even though it's an obvious example. Well, what's the explanation for that? And that's more or less what, I mean, how do you still do something positive? That's what I wanted to talk about in the rest of the lecture. So you shouldn't be then totally discouraged. It just means that you have to think more deeply about the issue to see how, at least in certain circumstances, you can rule out this kind of phenomenon. So the second thing I wanted to talk about is the theorem of Pfefferman and myself. So this says, or maybe I should say Charles Pfefferman. This says that if the manifold is compact, which I haven't been assuming today so far, but I will assume for the rest of the lecture. So for the rest of the lecture, it'll be compact and connected. Then, and this again pertains really in a significant way only to a large eigenvalues. F vanishes at most to the order constant times root lambda. So in other words, although this example shows that you can't have such a result for purely local reasons, or you can't have it on non-compact manifolds. Nevertheless, if you make appropriate use of compactness, you can quantify Ehrenstrahl and Cordes. You can estimate the order of vanishing. Yeah? Yeah. Okay. I'm pretty sure this is okay. Yeah. This is going to be a long lecture, though, I think, with all these questions. Yeah, that actually there's geometric dependence in this, too, so it depends only on the absolute bound of the curvature and upper bound of the diameter of the manifold. But I wanted to suppress that because otherwise it gets to more complications. Hmm? Well, upper bounds, I think, is the only thing. And so if you have say, upper bound on the diameter and upper bound on the absolute value of the sectional curvature, then you could give an upper bound on this constant. That's part of the result, but I didn't state it. Okay, so let me say something about this. Now this fits in well. I mean, this is, I guess, partly why I selected it. With a theme I tried to introduce in the first lecture of the spherical harmonics. Because now let's look at the harmonic polynomials restricted to the sphere. We show that those are the eigenfunctions. And if you compare this with the formulas in the first lecture, you'll see that this is essentially sharp for the sphere, meaning that we found the eigenvalues lambda k to be k times n plus k minus 1, and the eigenspace e lambda k was harmonic polynomials, or restrictions of harmonic polynomials, and if you want a specific example, you can just take the one that I had, x plus iy to the k on the two-sphere. So that would be something where it vanishes to order the square root of its eigenvalue, because the eigenvalue is essentially k squared, and these are polynomials of degree k, and that's a specific one which vanishes to match the theorem. Yes? Well, let's see. Usually you don't have that, I don't think, because, you know, in situations where there's no multiplicity, usually you don't expect. Mm-hmm. No, I don't think you can do that, no. But, yeah, you're right. I think that can happen, but I don't really know of any. I think it's a one-directional thing. I mean, in other words, I think multiplicity, as you say, implies vanishing, but then you may have vanishing without multiplicity. No, but I don't know of a bound the other way. I don't really quite know how it would be formulated. It would have to have this is something, thinking about general manifolds. I mean, maybe with more hypotheses, you could have some lower bound. But I wouldn't think you'd have anything if you put up on like generic. No. Well, for generic, I guess Uhlenbeck proved that the right. Yeah. But that's a kind of non, I mean, it's a kind of negative. He says that you don't have vanishing. Yeah.
Well, I don't remember.
Okay, so let me say how, you know, you overcome the difficulty which this seems to suggest. In other words, how do you bring the compactness into play? Now, at first we thought that that would require some new kind of global Carloman inequality or something like that, but actually it doesn't. It just requires a more sophisticated use of the kind of argument which I described over here. So let me say then roughly how that goes. Suppose then in the same Carloman inequality, we work again on a ball locally, and we make the following hypothesis. So suppose the parameter beta is bigger than this. These are two sufficiently large constants, A1 and A2. And also, and this is somehow the idea, beta is bigger than the log of the maximum Okay, and here again, it's like in the theorem of the column inequality, still up there, where h is less than h naught is sufficiently small. Okay, so then using this version, and that's why I needed, I mean, it wasn't really needed for Aaron-Chan quarters, but using this version where you're very careful about that C1 and C2 are independent of lambda, and a more careful but and still quite elementary argument like the one that I described, you can prove the following. So the first thing is that if beta satisfies both of these things, then you get the maximum r less than delta of f greater than a constant times delta to d1 beta times the maximum of h over 10 less than r less than h over 5 of f. So what, you know, just philosophically does this say? It's still all local, but it accounts for this example in the following way. It says, suppose the eigenfunction vanishes to high order, then there are two explanations, possible explanations. Either the eigenvalue is big, or on some concentric balls, the eigenfunction grows rapidly. That's the sort of intuitive content of the first part. And the second part is that if this is like something like a sort of three circles theorem, the second part, but for eigenfunctions. Just my constants got sort of confused here. All right, well, I might as well continue with them. I don't know why I did this. Okay, so then you have okay, so this is something like the three-circle theorem, except that it's the Hadamard three-circle theorem, except that it's less precise, but has the advantage of applying to eigenfunctions of operators with variable coefficients. It's not about harmonic functions like the classical three-circle theorem. Now, this one also, I don't think I have time to really go through the details of it, but the proof still, let's see if I have what blackboards I have here. So the proof of the proposition 3 is still a fairly elementary consequence of the Carlman inequality, so it's a consequence of the Carlman inequality. And a more careful use of cutoff functions. So the cutoff function there I selected was very crude, but with more thought, you can get quite a bit more mileage out of the Carlman inequality. So although I omitted both this and the proof of the Carlman inequality, I would say the Carlman inequality certainly is a far more demanding thing, at least certainly in the amount of time we put in to try to prove it the column inequality looks like the more difficult result. Yeah. This is it. So anyway, let me get then to the thing that I wanted to give some details about the proof of the theorem too. So still this proposition 3, I mean, it's strictly local. So it just takes place, all the calculation and the Coleman inequality itself in a fixed chart. Right? And we know we'll have to bring in the compactness somehow because of the example in some way to prove this vanishing, because it's not true on Rn. So how are we going to do it? Now, you might think, and I guess we thought that for a while, that it would require some sort of globalization of the Coleman inequality, that you'd have to do that on the whole compact manifold. But in fact, although certainly compactness has to be used, it actually only has to be used in a relatively elementary way. So the bulk of the proof, in some sense, is already done. So let me say how then the compactness is used. So suppose we then are on the compact manifold, we normalize the eigenfunction to have a soup norm 1. And then we choose some point in the manifold where the value is 1. So roughly speaking, as I said, either the eigenvalue is big or the function grows rapidly on concentric balls. But, I mean, if the thing is compact, it can't just grow everywhere, right? Because there has to be a place where it reaches its maximum. Okay, so then suppose then you want to estimate the order of vanishing at some other point. So here's the point where it assumes its supremum. You want to estimate the order of vanishing at an arbitrary point, say that it vanishes to order at most root lambda, or constant times root lambda. Okay, so then what do? You choose a chain of overlapping balls which join this point to Q. Right? So you have concentric balls centered at a sequence of points on some segment joining them. This is why the diameter comes into the estimate in the end. So you choose these concentric overlapping balls joining P to Q. Well, that's true. I mean, you need the injectivity radius too, right? So you need diameter and injectivity radius, because you have to have the ball small enough so you can apply this Coleman inequality. Okay, so you choose then a sequence of points x naught, x one, x two, L. I guess in my notation, I suppose I've changed it here, the Q, and you have xi plus 1 in ball, the is xi h over 10. And then you apply this three-circle type result repeatedly, inductively. So you apply proposition 3, part 2, and induction. To get the maximum ball xi, it is h over 10 f greater or equal to so then you go. And then on this point, then you have some control where you can use proposition 3, 1, and you know something about what beta. The beta is at most order root lambda. So let's see, I guess I have space here. What time do I have? Too much time. All right, so, so now I just apply proposition 3, number 1, with beta equals d3 root lambda plus EL. See, so although compactness is needed to prove the theorem, it's really used in quite an elementary way. The bulk of the theorem comes out of the local stuff, which is a consequence of the Carlin inequality. Now, as I said, this is a series of expository lectures, and I picked this out because I thought it was something that was easily explained, even to beginners. It's part of a larger part of work where Brafferman and I estimated the Hausdorff dimension of the nodal set, and this is somehow the first crucial step in that. Let me mention a conjecture by Yao, although this is for the extremely ambitious people in the audience to attempt this conjecture. And I'll stop there. Well, you can certainly do it if you have manifold with boundary with some kind of boundary conditions, yeah. Well, not as far as I can see. I don't, because it's hard to see how you're going to get out of that first example of the spherical harmonics on the ball. The extent which anything is true, I think, is contained in this proposition, really. You can estimate the order of vanishing using both the eigenvalue and the growth on concentric balls. All right, so let me finish up here with this conjecture of Yao. So it says that for eigenfunctions on compact manifolds, there should be upper and lower bounds. So n is a set of points in the manifold such that f of x is equal to 0 in the nodal set. Now this is almost an n minus 1 dimensional manifold, but it might have some singularities, but that's not really so important. So h, script h, is the Hausdorff dimension of this thing, which is essentially an n minus 1 dimensional manifold. And this was proved by myself and Pfefferman. Under a strong hypothesis for real analytic metrics. Now, the thing I've shown today is somehow the first crucial step in that, that even for C infinity metrics, the eigenfunction vanishes at most order root lambda. And then in proving this result, the partial solution of Yau's conjecture, the things I've shown here are still crucial, like these growth estimates, but there's a lot more which goes into this. And it seems like the conjecture for C infinity metrics is very, very difficult. So that's why I say it's only for the very ambitious if you want to try that. So that's the Hausdorff measure. So H script H n minus 1, the n minus 1 dimensional Hausdorff measure. And I guess n is the dimension of m, I should say. So he says related to order of vanishing because, say, if n was 2, if you had a point where the function vanishes to high order, it'll actually look at that singularity like a bunch of lines coming out here. So this is good evidence to start, I guess, that the thing might be true because it at least seems to bound intuitively how much of this nodal set is going to pile up at the singularities. But that's just intuitive. Actually getting an estimate on the length in that case is a lot more, especially the upper bound. In two dimensions, the lower bound is rather obvious, but the upper bound is still significant. Well, I'd have to think through that. I mean, there's certainly some sort of connection there, but I'm not sure exactly what it would be. I mean, mm-hmm.